Next case this afternoon is In Re Interest of Joshua C.
Looks like there's two of them, I believe.
Okay. It looks like there are two attorneys here for the appellees. Is that correct? Have you discussed how you're going to divide the 10 minutes?
We'd like to just take 5 minutes.
5 minutes each? Okay. All right. Very good. Is appellant ready?
Yes.
You may proceed.
Thank you.
Yeah,
I'd like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal. May it please the court, I'm Joy Souter. I'm an assistant public defender in Douglas County, Nebraska, and I represent the natural mother in this appeal that's before the court. Your Honors, I'm sure you're familiar with the exhibits that have been offered to the court and the record as the nature of this appeal. You specifically directed us to address whether this is a final appealable order, and I'd like to first address that if I may. The direction from this court in our briefs as to that matter specifically referred to how, in comparison to the case Taylor R., this appeal was a final appealable order. And I think, Your Honors, that this is a final appealable order that I've presented to the court based on one sole distinction, and that goes like this. In the case of Taylor R., there was a permanency change that took reunification off the table, but a rehabilitative plan was still included in that order from the trial court. The appeal was not considered a final appeal order because this court determined that because a rehabilitative plan was still incorporated, despite the change of permanency, that it was not a final appealable order. In contrast, later in this term of 2013, this court decided In Re Deanna M. or Diana M. With that case, there was a permanency change that took reunification off the table, but there was no rehabilitation plan that was included in the order from the trial court. And this court determined that because there was no rehabilitation plan included, that coupled with no further reasonable efforts and also no opportunity at reunification, that then there was a final appealable order at issue which met the requirements both in affecting a parent's liberty interest in raising a child, thus the object of the order, and then the length of time that the order would affect the parent's relationship with the juvenile because it would be indefinite or there would be no determined duration of that effect. It was therefore a final appealable order. What this really boils down to here, Your Honors, is whether or not the trial court's inclusion in the final order from February 15th, 2013, the court ordered no further reasonable efforts, a change in permanency objective to adoption, but allowed for therapeutic / supervised visitation. So the issue, as I see it, and as I would argue to the court, is whether or not supervised / therapeutic visitation is in fact a rehabilitative plan. If this court were to adopt that, then the stage is being set for many cases in the future that would come before this court, that those two, one, basically visitation of a parent with her children is enough, could be enough, to lead towards reunification, to opening the doors back up. In contrast, what I would argue to the court also, what I also would argue to the court is that if no further reasonable efforts are required, which the lower court held, but then also ordered therapeutic / supervised visitation, well, that's considered to be a reasonable effort. So conflicting orders or findings within that February 15th, 2013 order conjoined with the change of permanency, no further reasonable efforts required, and the finding that reasonable efforts had been made, my argument to this court is that that did make this a final appealable order, and therefore this court has proper jurisdiction over this. If there are no questions further about the the jurisdiction of this court. What has happened in this case is that it's been open for a while. There's no question about that. The guardian ad litem for the minor children moved in this matter for an evidentiary hearing to be heard in conjunction with a review and permanency planning hearing. That hearing took place over a span of 4 months, from November of 2012 through February of 2013. Testimony was elicited from a caseworker that was put onto the case. She's an employee of the Nebraska Families Collaborative, who is the designate from the Department of Health and Human Services to handle these cases in Douglas County, Nebraska. That witness, Ms. Thirkel, had taken over as the family permanency specialist December 1st of 2012.
But hadn't she had previous contact with this family?
She had.
In a different capacity?
She was under a different name, but in essence the same role about a year and a half, 2 years prior, when ABC, whose name the acronym stands for escapes me right now, but when KVC was one of the privatized companies, Ms. Thirkel did work for KVC. So she had had a prior history with this family, yes. When Ms. Thirkel, the worker just prior to Ms. Thirkel, December 1st, 2012, in June of 2012, a worker named Kelly Fuchsa was on the case. From June of 2012 through December 2012, those are in essence the months that are at issue as far as the basis of my appeal. Ms. Thirkel testified that when she resumed responsibility for case management for this family, she had to set up services. And tied into the reasonable efforts not having been made, that argument to the court, and the court finding that no further reasonable efforts were necessary, it's important, and I think it's necessary, that you look at the efforts of the parent in conjunction with the efforts of the Department of Health and Human Services. I know that it is uncommon for this court to look at the question of reasonable efforts when we're not dealing with the termination of parental rights. I understand that. But the record and the facts as they've been laid out very articulately by the guardian ad litem and by the state as well in their briefs to the court, my client is an admitted methamphetamine addict. She is. And she went through a period of sobriety. It's outlined in the guardian ad litem's brief. She had housing. She had graduated successfully from treatment. And around the time that Ms. Fuchsa took over this case, services dropped off. What happened in that time? We don't know. But what we do know is that unfortunately, my client eventually relapsed. And so Ms. Thirkel, when she took over December 1st, worked hard. She did a great job testifying. The guardian ad litem, again, and the state very clearly articulated this in their brief. She took over and she made efforts. But even within that, her testimony is conflicting information. They talk about drug tests, UAs not having been set up, or my client not participating. But there's also testimony that my client didn't have a phone that worked. And there was testimony that was elicited, for example, about a drug patch. That could have been utilized for drug, that would have taken care of issues with phone calls, with transportation and the like. A person would have to come out, put a patch on, and come 30 days later and put on another one. That was not offered to my client. There are...
This was all presented to the lower court, was it not?
Yes, it was presented to the lower court. And my argument... Thank you, Your Honor, for pointing this out. It was presented to the lower court, and that's why I argue today that it was error for the lower court to find that reasonable efforts had been made, and at the same time, no further efforts were further required, simply because my client did digress. But my client was before the court because she needed to be. That's why the juvenile court takes jurisdiction over these cases. These people need help. My clients need help.
But at the dispositional phase, aren't we talking about the best interests of the children?
We're always talking about the best interests of the children, for sure.
And how long are those services supposed to be provided until a parent finally wakes up and says it's time to become a parent? How long are you supposed to go?
Statutorily speaking, there's grounds where 15 out of the prior 22 months, that can be enough. There's also case law that says that if a parent is making progress, then time alone cannot, maybe should not be the clear indicator of what's best for that child. And it is impossibly hard to rule on these cases, I understand, because setting a precedent for all of the children of Nebraska, based on the facts of this case, is very hard. But my point to the court, if I may, is that while each side is required, parent and state, to provide reasonable services, to make efforts, one needs it, and one side is ordered to provide it.
One last question. I know you're out of time. I'll make it brief, hopefully. You mentioned that we don't often hear talking about reasonable efforts when it's not a termination. Are you aware of any cases that have discussed on appeal this particular issue when it's not at the termination phase?
No, you're
okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Counsel.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
Good afternoon.
May it please the Court, my name is Mary Stiles, and I'm a senior certified law clerk working under the supervision of Jennifer Crystal Clark, Deputy County Attorney for Douglas County, representing the state of Nebraska as the appellee. I'd like to start by addressing reasonable efforts made by the state in this case. This case has been open since April of 2010, when the children were removed from the appellant's home after the appellant tested positive for methamphetamines. Since that time, a list of services of attempts that have been made by the state are in the order appealed from. I think it's important to note that these services began in November of 2010 when the appellant decided that she wanted to work for reunification. Prior to that, the appellant hadn't seen the children since June of 2010, and her whereabouts were unknown. Since November of 2010, services were offered to the appellant. Services included visitation, therapy, chemical dependency, drug screening. The appellant in this case has consistently avoided or refused to submit to court-ordered urinary analysis tests. In September of 2012, Owens and Associates, who had been responsible for administering the tests, discharged the appellant for noncompliance. And then in the bill of exceptions, in the testimony of Ms. Thurkel, who was the family permanency specialist, she'd been in touch with Capstone, the most recent test administration providers, and they were on the verge of discharging her as well.
If I understand the argument, well, I do understand the argument to be that there was a period of time of about 6 months that the records don't show whether services were being provided. So could you address that?
Yes. The first family permanency specialist, she was on the case from June 2012 mm-hmm. to November of 2012, and there was a lack of documentation during that time, but it was due also to the appellant's failure to sign medical and psychiatric release forms. She's living in the state of Iowa, and she said she'd been receiving services through the state of Iowa. So in order for the Department of Health and Human Services to verify that, they needed these releases to have her records released, and she's repeatedly refused and avoided signing those releases. In November of 2012, when the new family permanency specialist came on, there's been thorough documentation since that time. She has documented multiple unsuccessful attempts to get the releases signed. During the month of December 2012, when she took over the case, she attempted to contact the appellant 6 times to meet with her and coordinate services before finally she had to contact the visitation staff and arrange to just be there during a visit. And I know there was testimony that once she brought the medical release forms over and left them on the kitchen table for the appellant to sign, she said she'd have them by the end of the week, and she didn't. And then as to the appellant having, she did have a phone that didn't work. She was difficult to get a hold of. But I think really what we have to look at is just the amount of effort that went into trying to contact her. I think it makes it pretty obvious that it wasn't just, you know, a broken phone. The reports and evidence show that testing specialists, and it really comes down to trying to get these UAs, the urinary analysis, completed. There were at least 17 times in January and February of 2013 when Capstone tried to contact the appellant to schedule these these drug tests, and then during that time, they're still trying to get her to sign these medical release forms. And then at one point in February of 2013, the appellant admitted to a staff member that she didn't want to test because she had relapsed. She knew she'd test positive for methamphetamines. She admitted at that time that she was not attending court-ordered sober support groups or therapy. She wasn't planning, and she wasn't planning on getting back on track with chemical dependency treatment. The Department of Health and Services, Health and Human Services reports, the most recent ones, show that the appellant was still not following up on services, on court-ordered services. The state's required to make reasonable efforts to reunify a family to try and rehabilitate themselves, but the amount of resistance by the appellant in this case really calls into question the reasonableness of continuing those efforts. It's not reasonable to continue to provide the appellant with services that she's not willing to utilize, especially when the Kohler children during this time await permanence.
Counsel, who was it that actually requested that the permanency plan be changed to adoption only?
I think that it was Ms. Boyle requested the hearing. There was the hearing that spanned the course of a few months, and then the actual order came out at the end of that, and I believe in the order the judge kind of looks over the history of the case, and I'm not really sure exactly who requested the permanency plan change. Your Honors, there's no evidence that the juvenile court erred in its decision, that reasonable efforts were provided, were unsuccessful, and that the permanency objective should be modified to be adoption rather than reunification. Based on the evidence before the court, this was an appropriate order considering the length of the case, the consistent noncompliance of the appellant, and the fact that the children are still awaiting a permanent home. It is in their best interest to progress towards this goal. I'd ask that the court affirm this order of the separate juvenile court of Douglas County, Nebraska.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Ms. Boyle.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, I'm Lynette Boyle with Tejan Simon and Boyle, and I am the guardian ad litem for the two minor children in this case. Brendan and Joshua, who are currently 8.5 and 7 years of age, the case has been open for approximately 42 months, which should tell you how long these little guys have been in foster care.
Follow up on the question that Judge Bishop just asked, the case plan from the department that was presented to the court recommended reunification, didn't it?
It did. And if you take a look at the May 10th order from 2012, which actually is an order that addresses, I think, a lot of the questions that came up today as well, the case plan changed on that date to reunification with the concurrent plan of adoption. And there's verbiage quite clearly stated in this order that addresses the concerns that the court had because of a lack of documentation that the mother was participating in services. The order very clearly states all of the services that were in place. It talks about the reasonable efforts that had been made for this family, which was lots and lots of services. But the order clearly states that there was a problem because there was no documentation of these services. So again, we had a problem where there was nothing to sober support, nothing as to where the mother was with her individual therapy. All these services that were in place, there was nothing to say she was doing them. And of course, on down the road in 2013, we learned she wasn't doing them. That being said, she'd known since May that the court needed this documentation in order to proceed with this case.
Shouldn't it be a factor, though, that there was a six-month period where services weren't being made available to her by the state?
But the record doesn't indicate that. There was not a six-month period where records were not made available to the mother. For example, there's testimony from Ms. Thurkel that talks about the fact that there were drug testing services in place for this mom at the point in time in which, that six-month period of time, and the drug testing entity canceled them because of lack of cooperation by the mother. There was therapy. If you look at the order from May 10th, you'll see that the mother was involved in therapy. She was involved in a variety of different services. There was orders that went way back to the beginning of the case that addressed sober support and the expectation that she go to AA and she do a variety of different things.
At what point did she leave Nebraska and move to Iowa?
She went to her inpatient drug therapy in Iowa and never came back. She never came back.
When was that?
That would have been pretty early on. because by the late fall of 2011, she had completed the inpatient drug treatment program. And again, if you take a look at the record, when she went from inpatient drug program to outpatient, and where she started doing lesser intensive, lesser supervised things, the wheels started coming off the bus. Okay? And so that's when we saw, you know, and again, the May 10th order, which is T17 in the transcript, is really helpful because it talks about there's no documentation of the things that you're doing. There's no documentation of your sober support. The court, it says, it would be contrary to the health and safety of the minor children or child to be returned home due to the lack of documentation and verification of ongoing sobriety, completion of mental health, substance abuse treatment, completion of counseling, and meeting the children's mental health.
So it's not necessarily lack of documentation that services were being provided. It was that services were being accepted and utilized.
Correct. The problem was never that the services weren't offered. The problem was always either at a time when the mother participated in services, and she did. She obviously did not have any insight into the real issues of the case, but she did the services. Then what happened, and again, Ms. Thirkle addresses that, she wasn't going. The record was clear in March that she wasn't going. And so, again, the mother really has no one to blame but herself. A couple different things. There was always a usable and accessible cell phone. The husband of the appellant had a cell phone, and that was used for communication. They didn't always answer it, but it was used. The records were replete with references to Dad's cell phone. So, again, we had very, very, very uncooperative folks. A couple of other things. Just as it relates to jurisdiction, I did raise that kind of outlier argument as it relates to the change of the permanency plan, because again, the third assigned error of the appellant is that the judge made a mistake in changing the permanency plan from reunification to adoption. It was adoption the whole time since May.
Concurrent.
But
this order eliminated reunification.
Correct.
Completely.
It didn't touch adoption. And so the third assigned error says, I believe, is an impermissible collateral attack on an order that was never appealed. Adoption has been the permanency, a concurrent permanency since May. We can't now come back and say, hey, you know, the judge made a mistake in replacing reunification with adoption, because adoption's been there since May.
Has it been there in all of the orders, though?
No. Mm-hmm. We've jumped all over the place. If you go back, again, at the beginning of this case, Mom was MIA for 4 or 5 months. At some point in time, she came back. She got engaged. She was working the program. And she ended up with a permanency plan of reunification. The judge, on his own merit, his own motion, his own insight, changed it in May to concurrent plan of adoption. My motion that I filed in the spring of 2012 was a motion for some stuff and an objection to the permanency plan. I objected to the permanency plan because that plan completely eliminated the adoption and went back to just reunification. And so again, that was my concern. That was why I brought the hearing, and the court made a determination at the appropriate hearing as to reasonable efforts. And again, Deanna M., by the way, is a case that was not a termination of parental rights. It's a case that was a dispositional and annual hearing where the permanency plan was changed from reunification to, I think it was adoption/guardianship. So that, in answer to your question, that's a case that looked at reasonable efforts and stuff, but was not a termination of parental rights case. So again, the judge, we got the order and said, oh, okay, we've been changed to this, there's no reasonable efforts. So again, my motion was open-ended. I didn't like what the plan was. But again, I don't recall there being a recommendation. Now, the case manager, Ms. Thirkle, while that plan went in, her testimony was counter to reunification as being the plan for the children. So that's another interesting twist, is technically it was the state's agent testifying against the state's plan in this case.
Thank you, counsel. I see we've taken you over. How much over have we gone?
35 seconds.
And was appellant out of any time remaining?
She actually went 27.
Okay. Ms. Suter, would you like 2 minutes for rebuttal?
Okay,
sure.
Three things to point out. One, I don't believe that the argument of the guardian ad litem that because when adoption was added as a concurrent plan of reunification that and that order was not appealed, that this therefore is a collaterally stopped attack. I don't think that's appropriate because only when reunification came off the table, then did this become a final appealable order. So long as adoption and reunification were concurrent, then there is no final appealable order that would be in place. So I think that argument is without merit. The guardian ad litem points out that there were concerns in that May 2012 order about a lack of documentation that was being provided to the court from the Department of Health and Human Services and its designate Nebraska Families Collaborative as to compliance with services.
Was there any other evidence that your client was utilizing services that were not documented?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that for me?
Sure. Was there any evidence presented at trial that during that time that your client was utilizing services, but it just wasn't being documented?
No, Your Honor, there wasn't. But again, the lack of documentation, in these cases, parents for sure have a responsibility to participate and to make their own efforts towards reunification. I have never had a parent abuse neglect case where the parent has been required to provide their own documentation to the court. We're in a circumstance here where the Department of Health and Human Services has a responsibility to present this information to the court vis-a-vis reasonable efforts. These are the services that we've offered. This is the documentation that they've been offered. My time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You may be excused. The case is submitted.